And now we will hear from Mr. Scott Bourne, who's been with the CKUT News Collective for 1 year. Mr. Bourne.
Professor Chomsky, President Chavez has stated in a speech at the People's Summit in Mar del Plata that the peoples of the Americas have killed the proposed free trade area of the Americas. What are your thoughts on this and on the prospects for free trade agreements in the Americas as they've been envisioned, for example, by the U.S. government?
Well, I think Chavez is correct. They killed the proposals. However, if you know, he'd asked me, I'm not his advisor, I would have told him not to call them free trade agreements because they're not. They're not free trade agreements. Very far from it. The agreements like NAFTA and FTAA and World Trade Organization rules have highly protectionist elements. In fact, they have one core part of them is guarantees for monopoly pricing rights for major corporations at a level that has never existed before. That's the so-called TRIPS, intellectual property rights. If there had been any rules like that in place, while today's wealthy countries were developing, the United States would be pursuing its comparative advantage in exporting fish and fur. Certainly wouldn't have developed an industrial economy, and nor would anyone else. But those are the rules that are placed and put in place, and those are to ensure very high profits for a long time to come for the private tyrannies, which is basically what corporations are, which rely very heavily, just to make it more ironic, rely very heavily on research and development in the state sector. State sector is the dynamic core of the economy. Then they pick it up and market it. Now they're given monopoly pricing rights. I can't think of anything that's more opposed to free trade. Quite apart from that, a large part of the trade agreements has nothing to do with trade. It has to do with ensuring the rights of investors. So TRIMS, the other major part, has what it ensures is that, say, Canadian company, if it invests in wherever, Argentina, will get what are called national rights. It'll be treated like a domestic company. The human beings don't have those rights. Like a Mexican can't come to Canada and demand national rights, but a Canadian corporation can go to Mexico and demand national rights. Well, you just take a look at this disparities in power, and you know what that means. It means that governments cannot carry out programs to that will lead to sustainable and meaningful development for their populations, which would mean targeted investments, maybe to, preferences for women and minorities, regional concerns. I mean, all kind of things that a civilized country would do. Those are barred because foreign corporations, meaning primarily U.S. and rich countries, their corporations have to be given every right they want. Now, as Canada has just learned, there's a qualification on this. If there are disputes between the United States and, say, Canada, and the NAFTA, in this case, the NAFTA board rules against the United States, the United States just tells them to get lost. That's what just happened with the Canadian U.S. negotiations on lumber. Washington didn't like the results of the board ruling, so it just said, do something about it. They said essentially what Stalin once is supposed to have said, how many divisions has the Pope? Yeah, that's the answer. But these are not free trade agreements. I mean, there are deeper reasons. What is called trade is just an ideological construction. It's not an economic fact. It's important to understand that. I mean, take, say, the old Soviet Union. I mean, if the Kremlin decided to produce parts in Bulgaria and have them assembled in Poland and then the products sold in Moscow, all of those operations crossed national borders. But we didn't consider it trade. I mean, that was internal operations within a totalitarian command economy. It's not trade. Well, in fact, that's a good part, probably close to half, of what is called trade in the international system. It's, you know, Dell Computers produces computers in China and sells them in the United States. That's called it's called exports to the United States. In fact, if you call that what it ought to be called, namely exports from the United States, turns out the trade deficit declines radically. But it's not trade. I mean, if parts are assembled in Indiana, sent to Mexico, produced in Indiana, sent to Mexico to be assembled, and then sent back to the United States to be sold in Chicago, we call that trade between Mexico and the United States. It's all internal to a command economy, let's say General Motors. It's internal, which is a totalitarian system, of course. So it's internal to a totalitarian command economy. Now, that's not a small part of what's called trade. I mean, since these are, you know, private tyrannies, basically, mostly unaccountable to the public, we don't have close information. But the general estimate of economists is that this may amount to maybe 40, 50% of so-called world trade. So it isn't trade in the first place. I mean, let alone free trade. It's remote from free trade. I mean, the things that people discuss, like, say, agricultural subsidies, you know, those are real, but they're at the margin. And this is all quite apart from the fact that the core of the economy is the state system. I mean, you use computers, and you use the Internet, and you fly in airplanes, and you buy goods from that are produced in China and come over on container ships. You use medicines and so on. Most of the basic research and development on that is paid for by the public. It comes straight out of the state system. I mean, often for decades. Computers and the Internet were in the state system for about 30 years before they became the public had paid enough to make them marketable. Then they're handed over to private corporations. I mean, we're very remote from anything resembling market societies or trade or anything like that. So it shouldn't be called free trade in the first place, or trade even. It's just another mechanism for guaranteeing the rights of the powerful, which is not very surprising. Who writes the rules? You know, and there's, whatever these things are, they're certainly not agreements. Like, take, say, NAFTA. And it's called the only true words, correct words in the phrase North American Free Trade Agreement are North American. It wasn't about free trade, and it certainly wasn't agreement. At least if people are part of their countries, it was opposed.
Chavez also stated in the same speech that he knows the U.S. government has plans to invade Venezuela, and that if it carried out these plans, a 100 years war would begin. Can you comment on the significance of the statement?
It's not paranoid. I mean, the U.S. did support a military coup in 2002 to overthrow the government. It was the only country in the hemisphere to support it. And Washington had to back down, first of all, because of enormous protest in Latin America, where people regard democracy a little more seriously than in Washington, and partly because, you know, just the popular response in Venezuela restored the government. After that, the U.S. has moved to subversion. Again, it's pretty open. I mean, the U.S. is carrying out what it calls democracy promotion initiatives. That means spending for anti-Chavez organizations. I mean, suppose, just going back to the media again, suppose that Iran had supported a military coup in the United States, and then, you know, after the coup failed, it turned to subversion in the United States by funding anti-Bush organizations in the United States. I mean, would the Globe and Mail think there's something funny about this? I mean, would it be commented on? Well, does anybody comment on what's happening in Venezuela? I mean, the U.S. decided that it's, officially, it's charged as being a non-democratic country. It doesn't matter what the people of Venezuela think. I mean, Chavez is running about 80% approval records. Venezuela leads the Latin America in support for the elected government by a considerable margin. Democracy is regarded as the preferred form of government in the Andean region in one country, Venezuela, about 75%. The others, it's all about 45%. It just doesn't matter. I mean, what do people matter? We're the ones who decide whether it's the right government for them. So sure, he has plenty of reason to be concerned. And you know, what the consequences would be, I can't imagine. I don't think it's going to happen because the United States is in much too weak a position now. But the problems are quite serious. I mean, the U.S. has tremendous problems all the way from Venezuela down to Argentina. And in fact, it's beginning. The Bush administration has even succeeded in alienating Canada. That's quite a trick. I mean, Paul Martin the other day said something about how if the United States doesn't honor its NAFTA requirements, Canada might start shipping oil to China. That would mean, which Venezuela is already doing. That would mean the Bush administration has succeeded in losing its, at least partly, its two major oil suppliers in the hemisphere. And it's also in serious danger of losing control of the oil system in the Middle East. I mean, these people really have a talent for self-destruction. The problem with that is that, apart from what it means for everyone else, a wounded monster can be more dangerous than a healthy monster.
Your thoughts on the upcoming elections in Haiti and the events leading up to them?
I mean, Haiti is such a disgrace. Mainly France and the United States, but Canada too and others, that you just can't encapsulate in a word. I mean, Haiti did have one free democratic election in 1990. The United States didn't like the way it came out because the wrong man won. And it really was democratic. There was a man elected from the people, you know, organized, large, really active civil society had been organized in the slums and the hills and so on. And against overwhelming odds, they elected their own candidate. Everyone expected the U.S. candidate to win. Former bank, World Bank official. The U.S. moved at once to undermine the government. The time to give the details was very explicit. A couple months later came a military coup. The U.S. effectively supported it. There was an Organization of American States embargo, but Bush, number one, immediately announced that U.S. firms were exempted. Trade continued. Under Clinton, went up even higher. Turned out both Bush and Clinton were authorizing the Texaco Oil Company to provide oil to the military junta in violation of presidential directives. Meanwhile, there was the terror there was unbelievable. I was down there for a while. It's just horrible. And finally, Clinton decided that people had been punished enough, so he allowed Aristide, the elected president, to return, but on a condition. Namely, that he accept the program of the defeated American candidate in the 1990 election. It was obvious at once that this very harsh neoliberal program was going to destroy what was left of the Haitian economy, as it did. In the West, that's called democracy promotion, a noble effort to restore democracy. And Bush, you know, the country's meanwhile collapsing. Bush made it worse by effectively cutting off international aid from, so it spun into chaos. Finally, it kind of imploded. And now it's a total disaster. I mean, there's monstrous atrocities going on, mostly against the poor, as usual. The former army, which Aristide had disbanded, is back in force. And yes, there'll now be some kind of elections. The most, probably the most popular candidate, Father Jean-Just is in jail, safely in jail, so he doesn't have to worry about him. There'll be some kind of formal elections, and I suppose everyone will applaud if people aren't murdered at the voting booth. But the U.S., but the West primarily, and first France, which had a hideous record there, half destroyed the country. The U.S. then took over and destroyed the rest with the support of its allies. And now it's a wreckage. I mean, you don't know if the country's going to survive another generation. I mean, the people are amazing. I mean, they keep struggling. They keep fighting for their rights. I mean, they had a democratic election in 1990 that the U.S. can't even aspire to. I mean, there's no way for the population in the United States to elect their own candidate. I mean, there isn't a, I mean, the basis in civil society doesn't exist as it did in Haiti. But they keep on and they keep trying, which is astonishing. It's the way they resisted the terror, or 200 years of attacks by Western countries. How long they can go on, I don't know, not unless we help.
You've mentioned it briefly here before, but can you discuss your present assessment of the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the prospects for its people?
Well, the occupation is, first of all, a crime, period. That's number one, major war crime. Secondly, on top of being a crime, it's a disastrous occupation. We've just passed, it's just a year since the major study appeared in The Lancet, the major British medical journal, of estimated deaths in Iraq since the invasion-related deaths. I mean, at that point, the highest probability estimate was about 100,000. This is a very careful study by leading specialists in the United States and Iraqi specialists. Just past a year, by now it's way higher than that. Malnutrition has about doubled to the level of Burundi, according to the latest studies. It's worse than Haiti or Uganda. The country is such a catastrophe that it's literally impossible to report from it. I mean, the reporters are mostly holed up inside a highly fortified green zone, or if they get out, it's under heavy military guard. There's been nothing like that in the past. It's a complete disaster. I mean, it's pretty hard to find out what Iraqis think, but there are studies. The British Ministry of Defense did a study last August of public opinion. It was supposed to be secret, but it was leaked to the right-wing press in England. The Daily Telegraph and the Independent picked it up. Their report said that I think it was 82% of the population want the occupation forces to leave. Close to half the population support attacks on the occupation forces. 1% said that the occupation forces gave them more security. And that's British Ministry of Defense poll. There's a couple others which are more or less similar. But we can't be certain about it. It's in a country that's this much of a wreck. Hard to tell what people think. The country is being taken over by pretty brutal militias. The Shiite militias, the Sunni areas, an insurgency has been created by the occupation, which is extremely brutal. And the mostly Sunni areas, but now it's all over. They're also carrying out terrorist acts elsewhere. It was in Jordan the other day. The Shiite areas are largely under the control of the Badr Brigade, brutal militia, also trained in Iran, also largely under the control of very reactionary clerics. And Basra, which used to be an open city, is now becoming kind of like Afghanistan. That all happens to be going on under the eyes of the British occupation. The Kurdish areas are off by themselves. They want autonomy. If they get it, the Shiite areas will do the same. That's where most of the oil is, probably linked up to Iran. I mean, the consequences of this are just mind-boggling.
You are listening to a CKUT special presentation with Professor Noam Chomsky. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Yep, very glad to be with you.
Would you have time to take a couple more questions?
I'm afraid not. I got something else waiting for me right now.
Okay, well,
a video link.
Okay, well, I do thank you for joining us on behalf of the entire News Collective. We appreciate you spending some time with us this afternoon.
Glad to be with you.